BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to Havana Helmet Club. New episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episode a week early, first on BBC Sounds. Just to let you know, this episode contains very strong language and may not be suitable for all audiences.
When I was first in touch with Adam, he sent me a photo. We were communicating on a cloak and dagger messaging app called Wicca, which is partly funded by the CIA, and even features a setting called Burn-On Reading. The photo shows Adam standing with former CIA director, Mike Pompeo, holding a certificate and a medal. He looks back on the few months around when this photo was taken as a special time.
It was very strange to have all this support finally. And it felt like we had this golden window of like 6 months where everything was really going in our favor.
On January the 9th, 2018, at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, Pompeo presented Adam with the Extraordinary Service Medallion, along with a certificate. The certificate stated plainly that Adam had been targeted by unknown forces and subjected to unprecedented, damaging attacks. The certificate even seemed to thank him for pushing the agency to take notice by managing the situation in Cuba and stepping up into roles far beyond his pay grade and experience.
His parents came and got a tour of the private CIA museum. The agency says this museum charts its rich history and commitment to the art of intelligence. They keep various spy gadgets, a model of the compound where bin Laden was killed. There's also a large wall remembering the CIA's great failures in Cuba. All actions ordered by presidents who prized the CIA's ability to keep secrets, to do work in such a way that they could deny it ever happened. All along, Adam has felt people trying to deny the truth about what happened to him, people trying to gaslight him, even down to those foreign agents he believes were following him and rearranging things in his apartment in Philadelphia.
What does that do to us? Someone's been in my place and they've moved my shit around. Well, you just look crazy again. Now you've said you're crazy. You know, people say you're crazy. You come out with a far-out claim of some sort. You've already got shredded out. Now you're saying people are following you and someone's been in your house in the US. It just pulls away from your credibility.
In children's stories, sometimes the hero wakes up and wonders if everything had been a dream until they find something. A nutcracker toy, a bell from Santa's reindeer, a silver dollop with a bullet lodged inside. Some talisman that reassures them that at least some part of it must have really happened.
Adam sent me that photo from this day to prove his identity. But I wonder if he returns to this photograph and the medal and the certificate from the CIA, because it proves something to him too. He might have been suffering from a life-changing illness, but the words in that document prove that at least for this moment, before everything began to unravel, people believed him.
It's a very inconvenient document that they've handed us that says we were victims of attacks. I bet they wish they could take that shit off me now, but they can't.
I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford, and this is Havana Helmet Club, Episode 7, America's Backyard. For State Department Medical Director Charles Rosenfarb, 2018 got off to a rocky start. He felt Cuba hardliners had attacked him in the Senate over his handling of the crisis in Havana. And though he thought doctors at UPenn were superb and the problem in Cuba appeared to be contained, he did worry that they hadn't seen the last of Havana syndrome.
We kept wondering if it's something that was going to happen elsewhere, and we started to put in mechanisms to capture that, you know, reach that information to our medical people around the world. Anything unusual, you get back to us, let us know.
In April 2018, a report came in. A government worker in Guangzhou, China, complaining of symptoms like the patients from Havana.
We knew we'd better take a close look at this right away.
Catherine Werner began hearing strange sounds in her apartment in late 2017, after the story in Havana became public. At first, she dismissed the symptoms, but eventually her mother convinced her to seek help. The State Department flew Werner back to the US, where the UPenn doctors could examine her, along with the patients from Havana.
And the head of the team at Penn, I remember taking a phone call from him, and he said, you know, her story and the MRI findings is exactly like those other people. And, well, okay, now we have a second location.
Adam, patient zero, remembers that when she arrived at UPenn, it was all very secretive.
I got word about a week and a half after she'd arrived, and they said no one can talk to her. She has to go through all of this battery of exams. She cannot know anything from any of you because they didn't want us to sway any of her tests. And it wasn't until the day that they had finished everything and they were meeting with the government to confirm her case that I got introduced to her and we went to lunch. And I was like, first off, you're not crazy. This is real. I know exactly what you're going through. And she just broke down. And it's the relief, you know.
This had not been the experience of that CIA agent in Moscow, Mark Polymeropoulos. He says that earlier that same year, agency medical staff disagreed with his theory that he'd been attacked, finding more mundane explanations for his symptoms, and they declined to refer him to UPenn. But the US government seemed to be on board with this new case in China.
We had an incident in Guangzhou that was that the medical indications are very similar and entirely consistent with the medical indications that have taken place to Americans working in Cuba.
On May 23rd, Mike Pompeo went before Congress. He'd just left the CIA for a new position as Secretary of State.
We announced it to the workforce while we slept here last night. We have medical teams that are moving to be on the ground there. We are working to figure out what took place, both in Havana and now in China as well.
The Chinese foreign minister didn't just deny any involvement. He called the attacks themselves inconceivable. But the US issued a health alert, warning staff in China to beware of strange noises and unusual symptoms. And officials speculated, was this China? China working with Russia? Russia has also denied any involvement in this story. To Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, the new case suggested they were looking for an enemy with the means to inflict damage on American personnel anywhere in the world.
And again, happening in one country leads to a set of hypotheses you got to run down. But now happening in a second country really raises the stakes, I think, in terms of trying to get to the bottom of it.
Guangzhou is classified as a supercity, or megalopolis. Its airport can handle 80 million passengers a year, and it's one of the richest places in China. In Havana, it takes all morning to download Western news over an unstable internet connection, and there are hours-long queues for groceries. In contrast, for State Department employee Mark Lenzi, Guangzhou felt like the future.
We had a great life there.
In late 2017, Lenzi was one of Guangzhou's 14 million residents and part of the tight-knit staff of around 130 at the US Embassy. He was living with his family in a high-rise apartment building. His infant son slept in a crib next to a large picture window overlooking Guangzhou. And it was there, standing by the crib and looking out over the vast city, that Lenzi says his wife first heard the sound. He says his wife was puzzled by this sound and couldn't figure out where it was coming from.
She said, yeah, I texted the upstairs neighbor. Are you dropping something like over our bedroom? She's like, no one's been in there. I haven't dropped anything, like, you know. And my wife's like, what the hell could it be making that sound?
Soon Lenzi began to hear it too.
I heard that same sound probably on three or four different occasions, really kind of sharp.
Lenzi and his wife's new headaches and waves of lightheadedness crept up on them. And at first they put them down to Guangzhou's crisis level smog. But then, to their horror, strange things happened to their children.
My wife was giving my two kids a bath, but at the same time she heard the sounds instantly. Okay, imagine this. Both of my kids had blood just started streaming from their noses.
He began sleeping late and sensing he was off his game. Working on something technical at the embassy one day, Lenzi's colleague teased him about word recall.
He said, oh, well, you just turned 40, right? say, yeah, it's because I'm over 40, ha, ha, ha. But inside I'm thinking, this is not right. That's when I knew that this was more serious than just smog. Like, wait a minute, something else is going on here. What is going on here?
It turns out that Lenzi has a very particular set of skills. Much of his job is classified, but he describes himself as a foremost American expert on Russia. He's also an engineer. Months before the idea of a Russian microwaves attack was being discussed widely in the media, Lenzi came to this view himself.
To get my badge, my federal badge for the Diplomatic Security Service who I work for, a large component of that four-month training is microwave detection and methods and things like that. It's what I do for a living, Sam. So yes, if it sounds like I know what I'm talking about here, it is because I know what I'm talking about here.
He'd been thinking about those strange sounds that he and his wife had been hearing over their son's crib. They struggled to describe them. Finally, they took a trip to a hardware store to buy materials.
I got a sheet of glass, and I got these kind of lighter weight marbles, if you will, that wouldn't break the glass. And then kind of, we replicated as best we could the sound.
To me, this recording sounded quite a lot like what it is, a marble rolling around a funnel and dropping on glass. But this was Lenzi's attempt to recreate what he believed was the Frey effect, those sounds that occur only inside your head, that Alan Frey himself called sonic delusions. It would explain why Lenzi's neighbor heard nothing, just like Adams in Havana. To Lenzi, it suggested his apartment was being targeted with pulsed microwaves. And if that was true, he had a suspect list of one.
The government of Russia. And you don't have to be the Wizard of Id to figure that out.
Over the following weeks, Lenzi says his symptoms got worse and people at work told him he was acting testy.
Truth of the matter was, I was irritable at that time. I absolutely was. That's a classic post-concussion symptom.
This mirrors Adam's story too. Lenzi got pulled into a meeting to address this strange behavior. He says it's called a written counseling session, kind of a big deal in the diplomatic world.
You know, if that's in your file, you have a hard time becoming ambassador and things like this.
What Lenzi didn't know was that just days earlier, Catherine Werner, that first victim in China, had been flown home after complaining of her own symptoms. When he finally did hear, about 6 weeks later, Lenzi was hopping mad.
I was just telling anyone that would listen. I was firing out these email blasts to my colleagues saying, you should have been warned too. I should have been warned.
This wouldn't be the first time Lenzi felt let down by the State Department. Twice he felt they'd shrugged off leaks of his personal data. But he says what made things worse about China was that he believes Catherine Werner had been trying to get word of warning back to him and his family.
My neighbor, on three different occasions, went to the government and said, notify, please, my neighbors, but especially the Lenzi family. They live right next to me. They're in danger. Please let them know. Oh, yes, 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 we will. We'll let them know. And they never did.
I wondered, had Lenzi done anything to run down his microwave attack theory while he was in China?
Did you ever get anyone to come and check for radiation or anything like that?
No, I tried, I begged. But just because my bosses didn't do it doesn't mean that it was not done.
He's cryptic about who took this alleged reading and what was done about it at the time. It's important to the story because of what he will do with it later. But while still in China, Lenzi gave an interview to the New York Times. In the article, published on June the 7th, the Times shared details from an all-staff email Lenzi sent around the Guangzhou embassy, in which he accused the State Department of knowing full well that his neighbor, Werner, was not an isolated case.
Had I been medevaced in a halfway timely manner, my kids, especially my kids' injuries, but my injuries as well, and my wife's injuries, would not have been nearly as bad as they are.
Lenzi told us doctors in the US would eventually find that his youngest child, the son who slept in that crib, suffers nausea during certain balance exercises, and that his eyes track differently. There is, of course, no way to know for sure whether this would still be the case had his family got out of China sooner. But we do know that when the State Department sent out a medical team, they screened more than 100 staff, flying 15 back to the US for further tests. Among that 15 were Lenzi and his wife, who arrived at UPenn almost 2 months after the State Department found out about Catherine Werner.
How would that make you feel? It's outrageous. Outrageous.
But it's here that the story of the China cases runs aground. For all the uncertainty surrounding a possible cause of the illnesses in Cuba, Adam was followed to Miami by many others, and the doctors began to see what they thought was a pattern. The China patients never got that kind of reassurance. The State Department sent the Cuba patients to UPenn only after triaging and identifying them as what they believed to be genuine, unexplained cases. Rosenfarb says the China situation was messier.
And we kept pressing Penn, like, so is it the same? Do they have something similar? In the end, we found what we believe were explanations for the symptoms of all that could not be attributed to Havana syndrome. Our process, in our minds, eliminated those people as having being victimized by the same thing.
On reflection, Rosenfarb wonders whether sending the patient straight to Penn was such a good idea.
One of the big regrets I have is that we sent these people directly to the location where they knew they'd heard that colleagues from Havana had gone to, who had this, you know, non-natural event that caused some potential brain injury. So that, of course, is what they were thinking they had. And Penn is a brain injury center, so this is what they were focused on.
He worries, too, that it gave the team at Penn the impression that the State Department had already drawn conclusions about these patients.
And gave the doctors at Penn, they thought, well, if these guys, they're being referred to us just like the Havana people, the State Department must know that this was the same thing.
Rosenfarb says that in reality, the State Department had not made hard assumptions about these patients. He says there'd been a low threshold for bringing people back from China. He didn't think it was the time to be picky.
We're trying to manage a tough situation where people are scared, and it wasn't a time to sort out. So we are very inclusive. If there's any suspicion that they had something, they are part of the cohort.
Out of those 16 cases, the State Department only ever confirmed one as genuine. That is, China patient zero, Catherine Werner, which left the other 15 in limbo.
They could not be convinced that they did not have Havana syndrome. So that led to a lot of discontent among patients.
Mark Lenzi doesn't buy it. He thinks it's all political. Now this has become a hard problem to handle, the government was trying to shut it down.
Cuba was always much easier. It was always much easier for the U.S. government to blame Cuba, to kick out some Cuban diplomats, to posture and act tough. But with China, it's a completely different beast. You can't just close our embassy in Beijing and Guangzhou. These are literally the most important missions for us in the world, right? Our relationship with China is one of the most important, if not the most important, bilateral relationship in all of the world.
Adam felt the same way. He was suspicious of this new two-tier system.
But that's the thing. If you want hurt in Havana, it doesn't seem like care is forthcoming for people. You know, they're getting people care, but they're not getting access to these programs that I pushed for and helped set up.
Yeah.
Which is there for these people. That was the reason for doing it. And yeah, I don't understand why it's falling apart.
As far as Adam was concerned, they'd been building a case. More incidents in another country with ties to Russia. Talk of microwaves. It all seemed to be moving in the right direction. Now, disagreement within the government was throwing everything off track. But as we know from Marco Rubio, the former senator from Florida, who grabbed hold of the Havana syndrome issue while commentators quibbled about cricket sounds, uncertainty often makes way for a leader filled with conviction.
I don't think anything accidental happens to American diplomats in hostile countries.
In April 2018, Ambassador John Bolton became Trump's national security advisor. You may be familiar with Bolton. For decades, he was one of the Republican Party's most hard-line foreign policy thinkers. He says when he came in, Havana syndrome was one of several items on his desk that he wanted to prioritize.
This was potentially a direct attack on American officials. It caught my attention immediately, that's for sure.
By reputation, Bolton doesn't always work well with others. But Trump regularly watched Bolton on Fox and Friends and described him as one tough cookie.
Why do you think he picked you for the job?
Well, I thought at the time that it was because he agreed with a lot of what I was saying. Presumably, you don't hire somebody that you don't agree with.
And are you smiling because it didn't work out that way?
Well, I don't think he believes in anything except the greater glory of Donald Trump. He doesn't have a philosophy. He doesn't pursue policies in the way most decision makers and academics would construe that.
Apparently, Bolton's independent streak was a problem because Trump fired him after a little less than 18 months. Some sources cited Trump's dislike of Bolton's mustache as a contributing factor. Bolton denounced Trump as a useful idiot for Putin. By the end, Trump was calling him a sick puppy.
And as I said in my book, working in his administration turned out to be like living in a pinball machine.
Looking for stability in the Trump White House, Bolton hired a trusted deputy, his old work pal, Charlie Kupperman.
Friendship and commitment goes back to the Reagan days. And, you know, it was clear this country had some national security challenges and that Donald Trump was a different kind of president than Ronald Reagan was.
Kupperman and Bolton personally helped Reagan spread the worldview that was in style back in the Cold War.
Ronald Reagan believed that the Soviet Union was an evil empire and that, you know, the only outcome was, as he said, we win, they lose.
These two Cold War warriors still keenly perceived threats associated with that era. They suspected Havana Syndrome came out of that world, and they wanted to deal with it head on.
Was it being taken pretty seriously when you came in?
No, because I think they don't want to, because, you know, they would just as soon brush it off.
Adam, or Patient Zero, had felt that he'd finally got through to the top floor at the CIA. The director, Mike Pompeo, had awarded him that certificate. But Pompeo's time as director was now up. On his way out the door, he gave Bolton a heads up about where things stood on Havana Syndrome.
And he said, in general terms, I can describe the conversation, that we have this disagreement within the government, uncertainty about what caused the attacks, which is how he and I both viewed them. And he just felt the bureaucracy, both the CIA and the State Department, was not making progress toward resolving what had happened.
Kupperman says he told the new CIA head, Gina Haspel, that they wanted intelligence updates in as close to real time as possible.
I don't think they had the same sense of urgency that we had.
But the truth is that over the following year, they struggled to stay on top of Havana Syndrome. In the West Wing pinball machine, there were a lot of other things going on.
The first week I arrived, we had to deal with a chemical weapons attack in Syria. So I arrived on Monday and we were bombing Syria by Friday. So I was a little bit occupied the first week, and there were a number of other things that had also piled up.
Ambassador Bolton, you know, had a vision and how he wanted to run the NSC. So it's nonstop, though. It is nonstop.
As far as Mark Lenzi could see, nothing was happening. He says he was trying in vain to get medical care for his family. He says he's maintained secrets on behalf of his government for his whole career. But in this case, he felt secrecy was no longer an option. He decided to go public in a big way.
My neighbor, me. These aren't the type of people that want to go to the press. That's the last resort thing to do for us. We love doing what we do in the shadows. So that was our last resort to do that, right? They forced us to do that, and we had no other choice.
On March 17th, 2019, CBS network show 60 Minutes, the highest rated news show in America, aired a special titled Targeting Americans. Until now, the alleged victims had been shielded from the public. 60 Minutes put a face on Havana Syndrome for millions of viewers.
Over many months, we have been collecting evidence of what appears to be a hostile foreign government's plan to target Americans serving abroad.
The evidence presented in the show was far from definitive. It consisted largely of first-hand accounts of strange experiences. Lenzi appeared wearing tinted spectacles, which he said helped with balance issues and light sensitivity brought on by the attacks. His former neighbor, Catherine Werner, described a sound coming from nowhere, a pressure on her temples, her pet dogs coughing up blood. It was like a scene from a horror movie.
I started to get hives all over my body, really bad hives. I woke up with headaches every day. I started to feel tired. The simplest things would just make me very, very tired.
Then, that summer of 2019, Havana Syndrome struck at the heart of the very team taking this most seriously. In late May, Ambassador Bolton flew to London with the President to visit the Queen. On that trip, two of Bolton's staff on the National Security Council believe they were hit in their London hotel room. When they returned to the US, one of those two staffers believed she was targeted again while she was out walking her dog. She was outside a Trader Joe's in the Washington area. Over the next year or so, there were several more incidents in the US, including one that involved a senior member of the NSE who confided to Bolton that he'd been stricken while walking down a flight of steps by the West Wing.
Obviously, something very serious is going on.
The same individual being struck on multiple continents, attacks on an ally's territory during a presidential visit, and even on American soil within striking distance of the West Wing, and to Bolton's own staff. To some observers, incidents like these took the story of Havana Syndrome into a realm that stretched credulity. To them, it was outlandish to believe an enemy could attack Americans on their home ground with an invisible ray. But Kupperman, who personally dealt with the staff, saw it differently.
And they came to me, I said, you should have come in here the first day you got back. We take this seriously, and we know that something happened to you if you said it happened to you.
It seemed to Kupperman that Havana Syndrome was striking at the very heart of American power.
I mean, these people were marked. It's not accidental.
Why did you think they in particular might have been targeted?
Because of their jobs and where they were and who they were with. You know, these are people who have some of the most sensitive national security clearances.
The American incidents in particular convinced Kupperman that this was the work of his old nemesis, the Russians.
So they're signaling the United States that anybody is reachable by a Soviet-Russian target. And basically saying, we know who you are, we know where you are, we can reach out and touch you and do things to you that you can't control. We know how Putin behaves, you know. He puts out operations against foreign individuals all the time.
Looking down the pike, Bolton saw a grave and growing national security threat. Just as the great inventor Nikola Tesla had a century earlier, he envisioned a weapon that could take out an army in an instant.
If you had a directed energy weapon that could immobilize thousands of people at distance, you could incapacitate a government's decision-making capability in the middle of a crisis. You could incapacitate large numbers of its troops.
With these sorts of stakes, this would ordinarily be a question for the president. Trump had apparently been all for punishing Cuba over the issue. But now that Bolton suspected Russia was behind Havana Syndrome, it was trickier. Kupperman felt that the disjointed response from the government was giving people valuable cover to duck an issue that no one wanted to tackle head on.
Once we make a conclusion as to where and who is responsible for it, the next question is going to be, what are you going to do about it? And that's back to the arms control philosophy. If you find somebody that's cheating, what are you going to do about it? So it's a lot easier to say, well, I couldn't find anybody cheating. Because if you make that determination, what do you do about it?
Trump seemed not to share their view about Russia's threat to the US and the world order, and was attempting a different, more friendly approach with President Putin.
I did worry that if I said, we've got a hypothesis, there's a Russian-directed energy weapon that's harming our people, we want to do more research on it, he may well have said, oh, come on, I'll just talk to Putin about it. We'll get that straightened out. And that would have been the end of the whole thing, because Putin would go to ground for a considerable period of time or conduct their experiments somewhere else where we wouldn't find out about it.
Years later, when Adam heard of Bolton's decision not to approach Trump to discuss a Russia connection, he would be furious.
You don't get to dictate that. That's not your job. Your job is not to withhold information from the president, whether you like him or not, or whether you think they can handle it or not. That's not your job.
At the time, though, Bolton felt it would be premature, admitting that they were still working on a hunch.
If we had had more evidence, if we had had the ability to come to a clearer conclusion, obviously we would have to go to the president. But in the ambiguous, amorphous situation we were in at the time, I felt that it was both premature and potentially dangerous that the whole thing would be shut down.
So under Trump, there would be no aggressive investigation of this alleged Russia connection. But what happened next might surprise you. Bolton and Kupperman might have seen Havana Syndrome as a rapidly evolving global threat orchestrated by a world power. But they wanted to bring the focus back to that small island in the Caribbean.
Wouldn't surprise me if the Cubans had helped the Russians out. That hypothesis, I thought, was consistent with their past behavior.
When it comes to suspecting Cuba of having covert weapons, Bolton has previous. Fulton Armstrong, that former CIA analyst, told us about it.
Believing is seeing for somebody like a John Bolton. I believe it, therefore I see it. And damn it, I'll find it.
17 years earlier, back during the War on Terror, Bolton accused Cuba of using its drug companies as a front for making bioweapons, such as anthrax, and he warned that Iran and Cuba might get together and bring America to its knees.
But all of us who know Cuba said, wait, time out. There are much more plausible explanations for this. And by the way, there's no evidence at all.
The germ warfare claim didn't stick. But in April 2019, Bolton launched a fresh attack on the Cuban regime, using Havana Syndrome as the starting pistol.
To justify its policy of normalizing relations with Cuba, President Obama said Cuba, and I quote, poses no genuine threat. Tell that to the American diplomats who were attacked in Havana.
On the anniversary of the Bay of Pigs, Bolton said that America was ready to finish what they'd started. And by destroying the Cuban regime, Russia's old foothold in the West, they threatened to kick their Cold War nemesis out of America's backyard once and for all.
The destinies of our nation will not be dictated by foreign powers. They will be shaped by the people who call this hemisphere home.
Cuba is a huge failure of American foreign policy going back 70 plus years. And trying to fix it, I think, should be a priority for any American president.
What do you see it fixing it as? How would you fix it?
Eliminating the regime and allowing the Cuban people to pick their own government. It's not always an invasion. If you believe in the people, you believe in, representative government, the legitimacy, sovereignty flow from the people, then empower the people.
This time, Bolton wasn't talking about an invasion. Instead, they would starve out the regime through crippling economic sanctions. At that dinner, Bolton boasted of their achievements.
We have imposed even further sanctions, tightened restrictions, and scaled back U.S. personnel at Embassy Havana in response to the vicious attacks on American diplomats. From now on, no regime will target American citizens with impunity. Under this administration, we don't throw dictators' lifelines. We will take them away.
Bolton and Kupperman scoured the books for every last remnant of Obama's policy. They stopped Cuban Americans from sending money home via Western Union. They canceled baseball contracts. And Kupperman says they began the process of reinstating Cuba on America's most noxious blacklist for foreign enemies, the state sponsors of terrorism. Being on this list ushers in a whole host of new sanctions and restrictions. Cuba would be a pariah state, along with just North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Obama had removed Cuba from this list. Trump put them back on.
Sanctions take time. They're not a foolproof tool, but you can use them to impose pain without using a military option.
But how does, what I'm saying is,
keep Cuba out of the banking system,
That's what that does.
It does.
Over time, people can't send money. The country can't trade. Things run short. The hope was to make life so intolerable for the ordinary Cuban that it would trigger an uprising. The Cuban people would overthrow the regime themselves.
You isolate a country, and pretty soon you had people in the streets.
On July 11th, 2021, protests erupted across Cuba. There was an anarchic feel to the initial news reports.
Videos shared on social media show protesters chanting, with some overturning police cars and looting shops.
Hundreds of people have joined protests against Cuba's communist government in Havana and several other cities.
Once the protests began, Cuban Americans piled on, organizing sympathy protests in Little Havana. The Miami Herald newspaper ran articles calling for the new president, Joe Biden, to force out the regime. Senator Marco Rubio used the media to push the government to seize the moment.
What is this so hard about coming forward and saying, we're not going to tolerate brutality, we're not going to tolerate bloodshed, do not step forward, Cuban military, and attack and hurt your own people. If you do it, you're going to be held accountable.
Fulton Armstrong, that CIA analyst, says it even emerged that Cuban exiles working in the U.S. may have helped spark the riots with a targeted social media campaign.
They did Facebook things with pictures of President Díaz-Canel's head on a platter. And they said, come to the plaza or never come again, your chickens. It was very provocative. Parts of it were pretty sophisticated on very dry kindling, so it became a mass thing.
So that was orchestrated?
It was originated.
Yeah.
But most of the people who went out were obviously spontaneous,
yeah,
normal people.
It's a dirty game. It's rough. It's a rough game.
Before things could escalate further, the Cuban president got on the radio to call for members of the public to come out and block the protesters, which eventually brought them under control. Reporters tried to make sense of these unprecedented scenes.
What do you read into the president's response? Do you think he's rattled by this?
I do, yes. I definitely think he's rattled, and I think this is their absolute worst scenario. They're hugely significant in the sense that we so rarely see any protest of any description that isn't government sanctioned or government organized in Cuba. So to have something that wasn't just spontaneous, apparently organic, but happening in a whole series of parts of the island at the same time was truly breathtaking.
If this was another attempted coup, it failed again. But these forces would keep trying. Cuba's resilience is endlessly triggering. It's like that old American ambassador said, Cuba has the same effect on US administrations as the full moon does on werewolves. Havana syndrome might have been a weapon, but whose weapon was it? The way the Cubans we spoke to saw it, the answer was clear.
They want to strangle Cuba and grind it into the earth. That's what the US policy is doing.
Next time on Havana Helmet Club.
This ignorance of what happens inside Cuba and of what was in the Cuban minds that has led so many people to believe that this whole Havana syndrome story could have been true.
Where's the evidence? Science is made with evidence. Where's your evidence? The new syndrome, where is it?
They thought that I might potentially be held physical hostage.
But they're all in the pocket of the Cubans.
Explain that to me. These are just like scientists, right? Like,
yeah, every scientist is for sale.
Russians.
Russians, no.
Communists.
I am not a communist.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Havana Helmet Club. Listen to the latest episodes first on BBC Sounds.
If you want to be notified when the latest episode drops, make sure you're subscribed to Havana Helmet Club on BBC Sounds and have push notifications turned on.
While you're waiting for the next episode, you can check out even more gripping investigations with intrigue on BBC Sounds.
One of our all-time favourites, The Rat Line, is on that feed. It came out a few years ago now, but it's such a great series because of Philippe Sand's extraordinary personal connection to the story and because he weaves a plot that's as satisfying as any John le Carré thriller.
There's lots of other great series to discover too. Just search Intrigue on BBC Sounds. Havana Helmet Club is written and presented by Sam Bunkey and Jennifer Ford and edited by Guy Crossman.
Our story editor is Mike Olive and our producer is Larry Ryan. Additional editing by Simon Pierce. Original music by Tom Pintons. Sound design by Merrin Royards. Additional sound design and mix by Peregrine Andrews.
Commissioning editor for the BBC is Dylan Haskins. Assistant commissioners are Sarah Green and Natasha Johansson. Havana Helmet Club is a Yarn production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
From BBC Radio 4.
The Russians will be launching a satellite sometime in the next 3 weeks.
I'm Kim Cattrall, back with a new series of Central Intelligence.
This is a CIA covert op, top secret.
The drama podcast that tells the history of the CIA from the inside out. Starring Ed Harris, Johnny Flynn, and me, Kim Cattrall.
Miss Page, such a pleasure to meet a real American.
Listen to Central Intelligence Series 2 first on BBC Sounds.